minor things in life, but cognizant of the important things in life like friendship and laughter. But Mackenzie, like my brother Paul, and many Canadians, was particularly morbid. His favorite jokes were the mommy-mommy jokes like, "Mommy, mommy, I'm tired of eating spaghetti. Shut up or I'll rip the veins out of your other arm." Or the classic, "Mommy, mommy, I'm tired of going around in circles. Shut up or I'll nail your other foot to the floor." Morbid. Canada in the 1960s and 70s was a great place to grow up poor. During that time, the social safety net made it so that while I knew we weren't rich, I didn't feel like we were poor. Of course, we never went hungry, unlike my parents who, during the war in Liverpool, literally ate only one egg a week, the yolk on Tuesday, and the egg white on Saturday. The food shortage forced my father to join the Royal Engineers in the British Army at the age of 14, not because of the gathering storm clouds of war in Europe, but because there literally wasn't enough food for my dad, who was the youngest of seven. His only option was to lie about his age and to take the king's coin and food. We in Canada were fortunate enough not to have to take such drastic measures. We had universal health care, which meant that getting sick never meant extra catastrophe. Plus, we had fantastic schools and a low crime rate. We felt safe and secure. It's one thing to be poor, it's another thing to be poor and feel unsafe. One could say crime is the insult to the injury, but it's really the extra injury to the injury. Our relative safety allowed us a joyful innocence that can sometimes be mistaken for naivete. Our favorite things didn't cost money. Things like bike hikes, snowball fights, watching storms roll in, television, British Bulldog, Relievio. My neighborhood was filled with the song of "Ollie Ollie Oxen Free." And when we played street hockey, "Car," followed by "Game on." When we played touch football with three downs, you would hear kids counting out "one Manitoba, two Manitoba, three Manitoba," with the inevitable complaint, "Awfully fast on the Manitobas, eh?" This was no money fun. Of course, there were times when my brothers and I were aware that we weren't the Rockefellers. My winter parka was not bought from an Eaton's catalog, but from the discount store Honest Ed's. And the zipper on that knockoff parka never saw a lift ticket. Skiing was for Canadians. Tobogganing was for us immigrants. Super slider snow skates, were as close as I got to being Jean-Claude Killy. I never wore Levi's, but instead I wore Livs. And one luxurious Christmas, I got a pair of GWGs. My Adidas, or more accurately, my Nadidas, had four stripes and not the trademark three stripes of the so-called legitimate Adidas sneakers. I'd spend hours trying to remove the fourth stripe, but it left behind a discolored phantom stripe, a shibboleth of footwear, giving away my working-class identity. This book was almost called Canada. My Adidas had four stripes. Occasionally, a parent from one of the quote-unquote nice houses in the adjacent subdivision would marvel at my general knowledge, given that I was from, as they put it, the low rentals. It's not like I lived in, I quote, the hood. I cannot claim to have grown up on the mean streets of Scarborough, because even those mean streets could be awfully nice and hopeful. Mackenzie and I and the North York Spartans soccer club that we played for won many trophies between 1973 and 1978. I still have those trophies, and they mean as much to me as any award I've ever received. The ethnic makeup of our team reflected the new Canada. There were first-generation British Canadians, West Indian Canadians, East Indian Canadians, and Asian Canadians. We didn't have fancy uniforms. We played for pride. As a sidebar, I want to mention that my dad never missed one of my soccer games. Even when he had shingles and looked like the Elephant Man, he merely put on sunglasses and a hat and drove me and Mackenzie to the game. One summer, we played an American team. They showed up in a team bus, almost like a professional team, their team name permanently painted on the side. They had cheerleaders and giant Gatorade coolers. The coach had a whiteboard to illustrate plays and a bullhorn to call out set pieces. Their uniforms were a work of art, red, white, and blue, perfectly matching, names on the back, numbers on the shorts, and matching sock garters. Our uniforms were red, although orange would suffice, and matching shorts were optional. One Scottish kid played in cut-off jeans. Our home field goals were repurposed football uprights that didn't have netting. Not to worry, the Americans had brought spare nets, which their assistants fetched from the bus and promptly set up. The Americans finished their synchronized warm-up, changed out of their tracksuits, got last-minute instructions from the whiteboard, took a knee and prayed, wow, huddled up, and performed an intimidating cheer that would have even scared the mean blonde kid from Cobra Kai. We beat them 10-0. Halfway through the second half, at around 6-0, we had so much confidence, we substituted in our asthmatic players. One kid with a halo brace scored a goal from a corner kick. The American team, a bedraggled and beaten army, returned to their bus. We, however, celebrated by eating Lowney's Glossette raisins and by playing our team song, Shattered, by the Rolling Stones, on someone's Fisher-Price close-and-play record player. My dad came over and switched off the music and made us give a friendly wave to the Americans. He insisted on good sportsmanship. It was important to win, but more important was how you won. And it didn't matter if we were playing rich teams or poor teams or Americans. The Americans. They seemed famous to us. America seemed like a place where anything could happen. In Canada, you can support even the most outrageous claims of deviant human behavior simply by saying it happened somewhere in the States, eh? For example, did you hear about that lady that would steal babies from the hospital and raise them, convincing them that they're deaf? That didn't happen. Yes, it did. Where? Somewhere in the States, eh? Wow, those people are crazy, eh? Yeah, right. If I had to live in the States, I'd have to smoke a bag of dope every day. Of course, we Canadians frequently envy Americans. I myself was envious of the American space program. How come Canada didn't have a rocket? How come Canada didn't have a NASA? And come to think of it, how come Canada didn't even have its own car? I love American space stuff so much that I remember buying an Airfix model of the Apollo Saturn V rocket. It was 3 feet tall. I was green with envy that it was covered in American flags and had United States and USA emblazoned all over it. When I finished the model of the Saturn V rocket, I threw away the American decals, and instead I got a Sharpie and, in my steadiest hand, wrote Canada along the length of the launch vehicle. I found some Canadian flag stickers and placed them where the American flag should go. Well done, America. I was also envious of American television. Let's face it, America makes the best TV shows in the world. That's not to say I didn't love Monty Python's Flying Circus and other brilliant British TV shows. It's just, come on, MASH, The Dick Van Dyke Show, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, The Bob Newhart Show, The Ed Sullivan Show, The Rockford Files, Hogan's Heroes, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Rod Serling's Night Gallery, The Monkees, H.R. Puffin Stuff, The Muppets, and Hee Haw, which featured Canadian Don Herron as his character Charlie Farquharson, the radio newscaster for station KORN, an American station, and yet to us at home, he had the thickest Canuck accent going. I salute you, Don Herron. I just want to take a second also to give a loving shout out to SCTV. I'm so proud that they're Canadian. There's a lot of Bob and Doug McKenzie from SCTV in Wayne's World. Both sketches were unabashedly local and had a homemade feel to them. Thank you, SCTV. Thank you, Dave Thomas. And thank you, Rick Moranis. Growing up in Toronto, the local American TV we got was from Buffalo. We got Bowling for Dollars, which is pretty self-explanatory. The children's show Rocket Ship 7, which was so low budget we owe Canadian TV an apology. But the highlight of Buffalo TV was, of course, the legendary Irv Weinstein. Irv was the main newscaster for Eyewitness News on Channel 7. He is a folk hero in Toronto. Ted Baxter-like, yet much smarter and way more tasteful. He was the ultimate anchorman. To us in Toronto, it seemed like Buffalo was constantly on fire. We marveled at Irv Weinstein's ability to come up with synonyms for firefighters. For example, he could say, Buffalo firefighters today battled a three-alarmer in an abandoned rooming house at Lackawanna in Maine. In the next story, it would be, Buffalo blaze busters tackled a massive electrical fire in an abandoned factory near Grand Island. Or it could be, Buffalo smoke eaters today are still battling an unyielding inferno in an abandoned carpet store in Tonawanda. All the stories ended up the same way. Arson is suspected. Similarly, it seemed to us in Toronto that there was a 24-hour-a-day running gun battle happening on the streets of Buffalo. When I was old enough to steal beer, we developed a drinking game. Everyone had to take a sip of Molson Export every time Irv Weinstein said, Arson is suspected, or the suspect died later of multiple gunshot wounds. On one humid August evening, there were so many fires and gun battles in Buffalo that I almost gave myself alcohol poisoning. It used to wig us out when the Buffalo News started with, It's 11 o'clock. Do you know where your children are? Up in Canada, we were like, What's going on? Where are the children? Should we get in a car and go down to Buffalo and help find the children? When there was a snowstorm, my brothers and I would watch Buffalo TV and be jealous of Buffalo school children as the newscasters read out the names of schools that were closed because of the snow. We never had snow days. Equally upsetting was Kentucky Fried Chicken. How is it that a state that was one-tenth the size of my province, Ontario, had a dish named after it, especially one that was so delicious that my father claimed it had a chemical in it that made you crave it every 2 weeks? Equally puzzling was Colonel Sanders. Why was he a colonel? Later, I found out that he was a Kentucky colonel, which is an honorary title. My dad, however, a critic of the Vietnam War, said, Colonel Sanders? The Americans have even managed to militarize chicken. It was also a travesty that you would see toys advertised on American TV that were not sold in Canada. And if the toy was sold in Canada, the announcer would give the price and then a super sped-up announcer would tack on, Canadian orders at $10. Canadian orders at $10, that's not fair. Even less fair was when the same sped-up guy would say, not available in Canada. Cruel. We were obsessed with the Buffalo accent, the way the word top sounded like tap, the word dollar sounded like dollar. They worshipped Gad, and they loved their dad and mom. And I'm sure they would pay tap dollar to see their dad hanging out with Gad. But of course, Canadians have an accent too. Some Canadians think the Canadian accent is, by its nature, the absence of an accent, as if the Canadian accent is zero on any given accent measurement scale. They are deluded. The Canadian accent has its own vowel sounds, lexicon, and pronunciations. For example, in the Canadian accent, process sounds like process. Milk can sound more like melk. Margarine is pronounced margarine, like Wolverine. Tiger can slip into tagger. Decals become decals. Canadians pronounce New Orleans as New Orleans. In Canada, pasta is pronounced pasta, like Mount Shasta. And you'll eat the leftovers tomorrow, not tomorrow. Mother is not your mom, but your mum. And if she's a sex worker, she's not a whore, she's a whore. There are a few regional variations in pronunciation, even within Canada. For example, in Vancouver, dollar can tend to sound like dollar. In the West, your car would go in the garage, which rhymes with badge, and the front of a building, the facade, would tend to sound like the facade. In Atlantic Canada, they'll say something is right nice, but it will sound like it's right noise. And if you're on a tour boat, you'd be on a tour boat. Though in Vancouver, it would be a tour boat. For Canadians, the last letter of the alphabet is not Z, but Z. I remember with great affection the first time I saw ZZ Top in concert. Years later, I would meet JZ, and we would sit on a Lazy Boy chair, which I paid for with three EZ payments of $49.99. Then there are some phrases that are uniquely Canadian. In Canada, when you're sick, you're not in the hospital, you're just in hospital. Did you hear about Bill? He's in hospital. in front of his kids, eh? A knit cap is a toque. A variety star is a smoking gift. And you're in grade 8, not the 8th grade. In the States, if you were hooked up, you would say, I know a guy. In Canada, it's a buddy of mine, as in, a buddy of mine has some snow tires? In a fight, you don't kick a guy, you hoof him, as in, a buddy of mine got hoofed in the nuts. If you spit on somebody, you hork on them. If you step in a puddle, you get a soaker. If you suspect that somebody's crazy, you say, careful, buddy's mental. Someone who's a trash talker has got a smart mouth. No one is likely to call you on the phone, but they might phone you and have a call. Marijuana is often called smoking dope. A 24-pack of beer is a 2-4, which ends up getting shortened to toof. In Scarborough, a 12-pack of beer with a built-in handle is called a Scarborough suitcase. There is no plural for the word beer in Canada. For example, a buddy of mine got stopped by the police. They let him go because he'd only had like about 9 beer. On a side note, one of the most Canadian things I've ever heard was Joni Mitchell singing, I Could Drink a Case of You. They should put Joni on the $10 bill. A penis is often called a dink, but a dink is also someone who is ruining all the fun. For example, there used to be a shortcut to the lake through that fence, but some dink called the cops, and now we got to go all the way around. A common medical condition in Canada is lake dink. It's the shrinkage that occurs when a male swims in a cold lake. All the lakes in Canada are cold. A Newfie is someone from Newfoundland. Newfoundland joined Canada in 1949, the last province to do so. Newfies are my favorite people in the world. They love to laugh, they love music, and they love hockey. Where does it get bad? Newfoundland is an island off the east coast of Canada, and like all island cultures, the residents can be strange. For example, Newfies have an expression for being at home with your socks half on and half off, which they call Sunday feet. Why? Similarly, if you choke, something got caught in your Sunday throat. I don't know why. In Newfoundland, they have a very unique dialect. Very Irish, a little Scottish. There's a famous song written in the Newfie dialect called I's the Boy, which means I'm the boy. I's the boy that builds the boat. I am the boy who builds boats. And I's the boy that sails her. And I am the boy who sails them. And I's the boy that catches the fish. I am the boy who catches fish. And brings them home to Liza. And brings them home to Liza. Another strange quirk of Newfoundland and all of Atlantic Canada is the linguistic anomaly known as ingressive pulmonic speech. Basically, people in the Maritimes suck air in quickly when they say the word yeah. So try saying yeah while breathing in instead of breathing out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Supposedly, Swedes do this as well. I thought there was an asthma epidemic the first time I went to Newfoundland. There are other linguistic anomalies that only exist in a Canadian situation. For example, if you're in line for a water fountain and somebody ahead of you is taking a long time, you'll often hear, hey buddy, hurry up, don't drink Canada dry. In Canada, we have bilingual packaging with both French and English on the same label. When I was a kid, I thought grape raisin was a flavor, when in fact, raisin, is French for grape. Similarly, I thought cherry cerise was also a flavor, and of course, cerise is French for cherry. I thought there was Old Fort cheese when fort, or four, is French for strong, which is the equivalent of old. I only figured this out at the age of 17 when I asked somebody where the Old Fort was. And when one cuts the cheese, often you would simply say, did you cut? Because it smells cuttish in here. However, the Canadian dialect is evolving. A delineation can be made between the dialects of a young Canadian and an old Canadian. The Canadian actor Michael Cera has a young Canadian dialect. Elements of the old Canadian dialect can be heard in Bob and Doug McKenzie's Great White North sketches on SCTV. The old Canadian dialect in its purest form can be heard in Stompin' Tom Connors' accent. Stompin' Tom Connors was a legendary Canadian folk singer, somewhere between Johnny Cash and Pete Seeger. He kept time by stomping the stage with his boot, so much so that a plywood board had to be placed on the stage to protect it. As an homage, let's name the old Canadian dialect the Stompin' Tom. The Stompin' Tom has its own pronunciations, lexicon, phrases, and jokes. A Stompin' Tom would pronounce the word again as again. He would refer to his wife as mother. His dinner is his supper. Saturday is Saturday. And if something happened on a Saturday, it happened on the Saturday. They're likely to call the supermarket a chain store. Not a place where you buy chains, but a chain of stores. They will often refer to the hardware store Canadian Tire as crappy tire. Not because they don't like Canadian Tire, because all Canadians love Canadian Tire, but because older Canadians, like their British antecedents, enjoy complaining for sport, and they are happiest when writing a letter of complaint. The snow tires they buy at crappy tire will simply be called snows, as in, mother told me at supper on the Saturday that there's going to be a big storm on the Sunday, so I better put on the snows that I got from crappy tire. To the Stompin' Tom, snow tires are a form of currency. You can pay people for things in snow tires. As cigarettes are to prisons, so snows are to Stompin' Toms. Stompin' Tom's rear end he'll call his arse. If he likes something a lot, he likes it something fierce. When he goes into a Tim Hortons donut shop, which he calls a Timmy's, he'll get a double-double, two sugars and two creams. With his double-double, he'll probably get a cruller, which looks ironically like a snow tire. He will call someone from Saskatchewan a scatcher. If he thinks you're being offensive, he'll tell you to marten up. And if he feels you don't understand it, he'll splain it to you. If he's worried that something is volatile, he's concerned it might splode. He might kick your arse till you marten up as he explains to you that you're not supposed to do that because that thing's gonna splode. If you went to the store to buy cigarettes for him, he's likely to say to you, hey buddy, can you run to the Moken Gift and get me a deck of Mokes? If he's mad at you, he'll tell you to go piss up a rope. He calls masturbation pulling the goalie. He calls going to the cinema going to the show. But going to a strip show is described as going to the peelers. So he might say, hey, go piss up a rope and get your arse over to the show and avoid going to the peelers because I know you have a tendency to pull the goalie. If you pee next to a Stompin' Tom at a urinal, he'll always tell you, this is where the pricks hang out. He'll point out that the joke is in your hands. And as you finish urinating, he'll remind you that more than two shakes and you're jacking off. If you come in with new trousers, he'll call them slacks and say, I had a pair of slacks like that. Then my mum got a job. He'll ask you, hey, buddy, do those slacks come in men's sizes? Steaks are always yay thick. A middle-aged Canadian man's gut is a Molson muscle or a boiler. And without fail, he will tell a classic old Canadian guy joke. Why do Canadians like to do it doggy style? Because that way they can both watch the hockey game. Truthfully, the old Canadian would not say the hockey game. Instead, he would say the game. The great Canadian goalie Ken Dryden, a true Renaissance man, wrote the definitive book about the game of hockey, simply called The Game. Is there any other game? My favorite Canadian of all time who had a Stompin' Tom accent was Mr. Glenn Cochran of CFTO TV News in Toronto. Glenn Cochran was a community events reporter. As was often the case with many presenters on Canadian television, being telegenic was not necessarily a prerequisite. In America, the men have always been 6 feet tall, lantern-jawed, with a full head of protein-depleted hair and a gleaming grill of perfect white teeth. They speak in dulcet tones, free from speech impediments. Not so much in Canada. Glenn had the thickest Stompin' Tom accent with shushy S's as in shuffering chuckatash. He had inexpert microphone technique, wore corrective lenses, and his suits looked like they'd been washed in Lake Ontario. He was a study in Canadian affect, frozen, stiff, with a repetitive monotone sing-song. Even when he was in his 30s, he seemed like he was in his 60s. I got the sense that he must have said the following sentence at least once in his life. All right, which one of you jokers hit my kid? His patter for any given report was identical. It was almost like a Mad Lib, where values were plugged into his pre-written script. Here's an example of a Glenn Cochran report from the Sportsman Show in Toronto.
Here we are in Toronto, Ontario, at the Sportsman Show. There's plenty to do at the Sportsman Show, whether you're into fly fishing or skeet shooting. Over there's a 1,000-pound bull made entirely out of butter. But wherever you go at the Sportsman Show, enter two bikini-clad girls, you're never too far from a couple of lovely ladies. Glenn Cochran, at the Sportsman Show, CFTO News.
Had Glenn been covering the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, his copy would have read as follows.
Here we are at Chernobyl, scene of the world's worst nuclear disaster. There's plenty to do at Chernobyl, whether you're measuring radiation or checking for sores. Over there's a 1,000-pound boron sarcophagus made entirely out of butter. But wherever you go at Chernobyl,
enter two Russian girls,
you're never too far from a couple of lovely ladies. Glenn Cochran, at Chernobyl, CFTO News.
Glenn Cochran was such a big part of my life in Toronto. I had the honor of meeting him when he interviewed me in 1993. I did my Glenn Cochran for Glenn Cochran. He loved it. And I loved him. The song of the Canadian dialect is referred to by linguists as the Canadian rise. In the Canadian accent, there's a tonal rise at the end of each sentence, until the last sentence, which returns to the Canadian monotone. The rise at the end of the sentence is an indication that the speaker intends to continue. The end of the final sentence has no rise, which tells the listener, now it's your turn to speak. Here's an example of a Canadian talking.
A buddy of mine, rising, still talking, went to Canadian Tire, rising, still talking, and he bought a hockey stick, not rising. Now it's your turn to talk.
Essentially, we Canadians have encoded after you into our speech patterns. It's subliminal etiquette. The Canadian accent is not famous. Usually people only know that Canadians tend to say A at the end of their sentences. A is a bid for affirmation, even for the most banal of statements. For example, dogs are furry, eh? By placing A at the end of the non-controversial statement, dogs are furry, the speaker is compelling his listener to affirm the truth of this as if to say, dogs are furry. I'm correct in that assessment, right? Another Canadianism is that we pronounce bin as bean. They do this in England as well. In America, of course, bin is bin. I've often been mocked for saying bean, to which I answer, when you've seen something, you haven't seen it. Americans don't find this a terribly compelling argument. My American dialect coach for the movie 54, in which I played Steve Rubell, was from Queens, had to correct my Canadian pronunciation of B-E-E-N so much that he referred to himself as a bean counter. Every country has a resting face, a national affect. In The Labyrinth of Solitude, the Mexican poet Octavio Paz talked about the Mexican affect, describing it as stoic, yet with a servile hostility, pretending to see nothing, but seeing everything, pretending to judge no one, but judging everyone. Of course, Canada has a national resting face. In the Canadian affect, Canadian men display very little facial mobility, unlike their American counterparts, whose faces are mobile and engaged, almost over-connecting to their words. Canadian men have a frozen affect. The American affect conveys, look at me, I'm here. For the Canadian, it conveys, I don't want to show off. Canadian men have a disproportionate fear of being perceived as conceited. American men harbor no such fear. Instead, Canadians tend to have what Andrew H. Malcolm describes as a superior inferiority complex. The Canadian affect for women is very different. Canadian women tend to have a look of mild surprise, a doe-like, exaggeratedly open countenance. The expression equivalent of showing your hands to prove that you have no weapons. In tandem with this non-threatening affect, Canadian women will often inject a sing-songy, "Oh yeah," between your sentences. The intention is to clearly communicate, "I want to let you know that I'm listening." But to the American ear, this lilting, "Oh yeah," sounds like a super condescending version of, "Will you stop talking?" Or, "Seriously, do I have to listen to this?" When I was 6, my best friend in my building was named Corey Skinner, and his dad was Brian Skinner, a disc jockey on CHUM. The call letters of Canadian TV and radio stations all begin with the letter C. CHUM, which we called CHUM, played top 40 music and had a weekly promotional printout of, infuriatingly, the top 30 hits called the CHUM Chart. My brother Paul collected CHUM charts religiously, and he still has all of them from 1970 and 1971. CHUM had a promotion wherein if they randomly called you and you answered, "I listen to CHUM," you got $1,000. For my dad, this was his ticket to moving back to Britain. Without fail, he always answered the phone, "I listen to CHUM." One day, a group of neighbors had gathered in our apartment because one of our fellow tenants had passed away. Tears were flowing. Then the phone rang. My mom knew my dad wanted to win that money, so she said, "Don't answer it, Eric." But he couldn't help himself. As one person was telling a heart-wrenching story of our dearly departed neighbor, my dad picked up the phone and said, as quietly as he could, "I listen to CHUM." He did not win, but it did make everyone laugh. CHUM was our station, and even now when my brother calls, I have been known to answer, "I listen to CHUM." Paul has always joked that the "I listen to CHUM" campaign was so successful that, at that time, even if you had called a suicide hotline, they would have answered, "I listen to CHUM, suicide hotline, how can I help you?" One day, Corey Skinner said that his dad was going to mention our names on the radio. We waited nervously on the balcony with the radio at full blast. It was one of those muggy early evenings in June where it seems like it's never going to become nighttime, and it's so hot that even the cicadas are still making noise. At 6:05 p.m., Brian Skinner said, "I just want to send a special hello to two of the coolest cats in Don Mills, Corey and Mike." Corey took it in stride. I screamed. This is what I thought being famous felt like. It wasn't until much later, 2002 to be precise, that I truly came to know what being famous felt like. This is what being famous actually feels like. In 2002, I was coming home from Madison Square Garden, having watched the Leafs lose to the Rangers. I'd eaten everything that Madison Square Garden had to offer, popcorn, hot dogs, nachos, everything. We shall refer to this as my first mistake. In the cab, on the way home, I started to get that familiar warning signs of an impending diarrhea attack. The gurgling sound, shooting pains in the front of my legs, and a sweaty brow. I made deals with my body that if it would just let me crap my pants the second I got out of the cab, I would perform various saintly deeds. But my body didn't want to make a deal. It was go time. When the cab came to a stop sign, I threw the cabbie a 20, thus giving him the greatest tip of his life. And this is where I can illustrate the unique experience surrounding the frenzy of renown. As I bolted down the stairs to use a restaurant's bathroom, I was recognized by a young, overly effusive fan. Effusive fan. "Mike Myers, I'm such a big fan. Can I shake your hand?" Me, through a diarrhea quiver voice. "Not a good time!" I ran down the stairs. The effusive fan followed. This was going to be bad. I bolted into the bathroom. Unfortunately, it was a single toilet, single urinal men's room. It combined the worst of both worlds, small and public. The walls of the stall didn't reach the floor, which is often the case in public bathrooms. Why? In fact, the bottoms of the stall walls were particularly high at almost knee level, affording little to no privacy. I was about to afford myself some relief when the effusive fan decided to enter the tiny bathroom. Mr. Myers, I'm such a big fan. I just really want to shake your hand. Me, high-pitched. Kind of busy. That's okay. I'll wait. He'll wait? What? So there I was, exposed, in the down-and-locked position, using all the telepathy that I don't have, to will this person to leave the bathroom. There was going to be an explosion. It was going to be bad. This is what the effusive fan said at that moment, and I swear to you, it's the God's honest truth. Mr. Myers, what do you have coming out? Me, weakly, disbelieving. Shrek 2! That was it, the last straw. If he was going to stay in this tiny bathroom, he would have to pay the price. It was at that moment that a demon inside of me was released into that toilet bowl. A barking demon. Pee-pee out my bum-bum with such force that I was lifted off the seat, thus proving the Newtonian law of inverse and opposite reaction. Let me put it this way. There was foam in the bowl. It was bad. Very bad. A wafting so bad that it made the door handle hot. It was so bad that it was making the wallpaper curl. It was so bad that even I couldn't tolerate it, and I questioned its origin, for surely this fetid fog was not of this world. I was in a shame spiral. I don't know how the effusive fan was still living, but he was. What else do you have coming out? I didn't even answer at this point, and by now I wasn't running the show. Mr. Bowell was in charge, and he was just getting started. The second wave was more staccato, louder, and significantly more humiliating. It took a while. While I sat there in the crime scene, I was thinking of two things. One, I had wanted to be a public person my whole life, and here I was, pants around the ankles, in the world's smallest bathroom stall, literally stripped of all dignity. And two, how fast could I find this funny? I started to laugh. I finished up, and then left the stall. I was greeted by the effusive fan who was holding his hand out. Put it there, Mr. Myers. I non-verbally nodded to the carnage behind me and calmly said, Hey, buddy, let me wash my hands first. I went to the sink, noticing that the fog had indeed taken the shape of its container, the bathroom. It was bad. Everywhere. I thought to myself, if he didn't have the sense to leave the bathroom, I'm going to take my sweet time washing my hands. And so I pumped the soap container a good 15 times, partly to further punish, and partly in a vain attempt to freshen the air. I washed my hands thoroughly, to the elbows, like a surgeon. In my head, I ran through the alphabet twice. He stuck his hand out again. I went past him to the hand dryer. Although I would typically give up halfway through the drying time and just wipe my hands on my jeans, on this occasion, I stayed for the entire cycle, sarcastically smiling at him as if to say, Nice in here, huh? Aren't you glad you stayed the whole time? He was oblivious to my nonverbal communication. I shook his hand. Although I will spend many incarnations of my soul not understanding how, he told me that I had made his day. That's what being famous mostly feels like. Hours of shame sprinkled with moments of unexpected and unexplainable validation. But as I listened to my name being said on Chum by Corey Skinner's dad in that rent-controlled apartment building in the suburbs of Toronto in the 1960s, everything about celebrity seemed great. Even Canadian children's television seemed exciting, though in retrospect it was unbelievably low budget with very little action. Literally a dude, a three-walled set, and sock puppets. One of the great joys of being Canadian was knowing that our television shows were a little low rent. Mr. Dress-Up was a Canadian children's show that was Canada's answer to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Unlike Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, we never got out of Mr. Dress-Up's three-walled set that was his house. Mr. Dress-Up, played by Ernie Coombs, would draw and he would wear costumes that he got from the Tickle Trunk. As you might imagine, there's a whole generation of Canadian potheads who refer to the place where they store their weed as the Tickle Trunk. Mr. Dress-Up was joined by two hand puppets, Casey, a young boy, and Finnegan, his dog. Casey, the young boy, was inexplicably played by Judith Lawrence, an Australian lady with an Australian accent. Everything in Canadian children's television was about being cozy, warm, and safe. Even The Friendly Giant, a television show about, yes, a friendly giant. He had a one-panel set with a window where he could talk to Jerome the giraffe, and a bag on the wall where he could talk to Rusty the rooster. Rusty was a bit of a prick. He was argumentative and contrary, whereas Jerome was affable to a fault. I've just reread the last three sentences. I think I've gone insane. Nope, it happened. I remember watching The Friendly Giant with my brothers. At one point, the giant always says, "One little chair for one of you, and a bigger chair for two more to curl up in, and for someone who likes to rock, a rocking chair in the middle." When The Friendly Giant said, "For someone who likes to rock," we would break into air guitar and go, "Ew." My brothers were, and are, funny. Much funnier than I am. Most of my observations of Canadian life exist because I wanted to try and keep up with them. Never underestimate what a leg up it is in show business to have older brothers who are funny and cool. Thank you, brothers. I love you. For the most part, cartoons were American. We too had the Archies, Josie and the Pussycats, and the Flintstones. In Quebec, the Flintstones is called Les Pirafou. Pirafou literally means rock of fire. Fred and Delima Caillou, Fred and Wilma Flintstone, hang out with Arthur and Berta LaRoche, Barney and Betty Rubble. Bam Bam is Boom Boom. We thought it was the most hilarious thing in the world. There was one Canadian cartoon called Rocket Robin Hood. It was the Robin Hood story set in space. It was so low budget that the characters would repeat the same moves over and over again, and those moves could only happen every 5 seconds. It was like watching a graphic novel. Of a higher quality was the live-action CBC show King of Kensington. It took place in the culturally diverse Kensington Market area of Toronto and starred Al Waxman of Cagney and Lacey fame. The characters were recognizably Torontonian. I thought King of Kensington was as close to an American sitcom as Canada ever got. The lighting was fairly good, the sets were lush, the humor was local, and it had great pacing. I felt that Al Waxman and the entire cast really wanted to do well for Canada, and they tried their best to give the Canadian taxpayers, who paid for the CBC, value for their money. I spent the first 11 years of my life in North York, the suburb next to Scarborough. North York is remarkable for a precipitous style of large rental apartment building known architecturally as the Tower in the Park style, a mass-produced knockoff of a form-follows-function design. They were boxy, clad in white brick, usually around 17 stories, cheaply built and hastily constructed. Those buildings have the antiseptic charm of a tuberculosis ward. Almost every photograph of me as a kid from that time has one of those tower-in-the-park apartment buildings in the background. The exterior of the apartments were cinder block, topped by a row of windows so poorly insulated that my brothers and I would scrape the frost off the corners of the windows and have snowball fights inside the apartment. Often, during cold winter nights, my brothers and I would open up the window to the bedroom to make ourselves cold. Wearing nothing but our pajamas, we would see how long we could hold out before we needed to shut the window. Once the window was shut, we dove in our beds to warm up. Once warm, we were soon asleep. I have an abiding love of simple pleasures, and that apartment played a large role in that love. One of my fondest memories of that apartment is when my brother Paul brought home the newly released Beatles album Let It Be. We placed the album on our Canadian-made Claritone stereo record player, which was mounted in one of those large wooden cabinets that looked almost like a casket, but with four legs. We were never cold, but we were also never warm. It was one of those freezing yet remarkably sunny December days that you get in Toronto. The sun created a hot patch on our rug, and my brothers, our cat Alexander Monday, and I sat in that hot patch and listened to that Beatles masterpiece. Our minds thoroughly blown. If you had time-lapse photographed that afternoon, you would have watched us lazily move along the carpet following the warm sun patch. My brother was able to buy Let It Be because all three of us had paper routes. I remember being in that building at 5 o'clock in the morning, delivering the Globe and Mail, and then later that night, having to collect payment from the people in my route. I hated and loved collecting. Some of my customers were nice, and it felt like a performance to knock on the door and say, sing, collecting for the Globe. The hard part was when people didn't or couldn't pay. Sometimes my dad would get involved, but mostly I just struck them off my paper route. To this day, I have the sense memory of how each floor had a unique smell of home cooking. Indian food, Jamaican food, barbecues on the balcony. My brother Peter, ever industrious, had 3 paper routes. He worked himself so hard that he got a hernia, for which the Toronto Telegram gave him an award known as the Golden Bag. The irony is that the hernia had caused him to have a bright blue swollen bag, as blood had collected in his scrotum. You might imagine, to 3 infantile boys, how fantastically hilarious it was to have an award known as the Golden Bag. My brothers and I were always looking for ways to make money. Going door to door through our apartment building collecting pop bottles was one of them. But sometimes money just came to you out of nowhere. One time I was with my mom at a Dominion supermarket. I was wearing a snowsuit looking at a bike near the front doors when a photographer turned to my mom and said, "Can we take your son's picture and put it in every Dominion store across Canada? We'll pay you." My mom, of course, immediately said yes. This was my first paid gig. Another way to stretch the budget for working people in Canada was through Canadian Tire money. Canadian Tire, heretofore referred to as Crappy Tire, had a loyalty program wherein, for every purchase, you would be rebated a percentage in the form of scrip or coupons, which you could use towards future purchases. In many ways, my dad valued Canadian Tire money more than the Canadian dollar. I have an obsession with certain pieces of Canadiana, like Canadian Tire money, but nothing matches the obsession I have for the Toronto Transit Commission, Toronto's public transportation service, otherwise known as the TTC, the Better Way, or, after its red streetcars, the Red Rocket. The TTC is heavily subsidized by local, provincial, and federal governments. And for a working person, a safe, clean, reliable, comprehensive, and affordable transit system, where the seats aren't ripped up and the floors are immaculate, is a godsend. But to have all of that and fantastic signage, logos, and a consistent color scheme and platform designs is beyond a godsend, especially when you know that this is a government program. The most remarkable Canadian governmental program that my family and I have ever benefited from was the Ontario Health Insurance Plan, OHIP. OHIP is the provincially run single-payer health insurance system. Like all families, we've had our share of medical drama, but as a kid, I never feared we would be out on the street if one of us got a catastrophic illness. OHIP is not free. Our tax rate is slightly higher than some countries. OHIP is not a perfect system, but in a world of no HIP, OHIP looks pretty good. OHIP, and all of the other provincial single-payer systems across the nation, is one of the things I am most proud of in Canada. The public schools that I went to in Canada, in retrospect, were pretty fantastic. Clean, safe, with a high level of achievement expected of you. Whatever Welcome Back Cotter was, Canada wasn't. Not to say that it was Harry Potter, but it was somewhere in between. For me, I feel that there's been a fantastic return on the money that was paid in taxes for my Canadian public school education. I feel that I was prepared for citizenship and that the playing field was leveled. In fact, my political philosophy could be called level playing fieldism. I'm a progressive capitalist. If you build a better mousetrap, you should be rewarded for that mousetrap. But I also believe that all capable citizens should be given the chance to build that better mousetrap. Talent is a blind pixie that taps its wand on the prodigious, unaware of whether you're a male or female, white or a person of color, gay or straight, rich or poor. Mostly, I believe in the just society that my hero, Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, described as follows. The Just Society will be one in which the rights of minorities will be safe from the whims of intolerant majorities. The Just Society will be one in which those regions and groups which have not fully shared in the country's affluence will be given a better opportunity. The Just Society will be one where such urban problems as housing and pollution will be attacked through the application of new knowledge and new techniques. The Just Society will be one in which our Indian and Inuit populations will be encouraged to assume the full rights of citizenship through policies which will give them both greater responsibility for their own future and more meaningful equality of opportunity. The Just Society will be a united Canada, united because all of its citizens will be actively involved in the development of a country where equality of opportunity is ensured and individuals are permitted to fulfill themselves in the fashion they judge best. What a fantastic platform. And what a fantastic time in politics that was, when politicians proffered their opinions about governance, as opposed to the current trend in politics, where politicians proffer their opinions about their opponents. I have benefited greatly from governmental attempts to level the playing field. In 1975, we moved from North York to Scarborough into a rent-subsidized government co-op. It was a Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, or CMHC, townhouse. The CMHC is a government corporation set up to help new Canadian families enter the housing market. Part of your rent was subsidized, part went to the CMHC, and another part went towards the purchase of a house. We went from apartment living to townhouse living in Scarborough. In Toronto, Scarborough has the delightful nickname of Scarberia. While there are some rough bits, Scarborough is predominantly working class to middle class, with lovely neighborhoods and some upmarket subdivisions. Many of the Scarborough subdivisions made in the 70s have a strange Soviet yet petit bourgeois quality. The net effect is that some of these so-called, quote, nice houses end up looking like a combination of a steakhouse and a funeral home. A lot of wrought iron exterior lanterns, partial fieldstone walls, poor man's Gothic. Scarborough is plagued by a crushing flatness, ubiquitous car dealerships, factory carpet outlets, and strip malls. Scarborough is where I learned the joys of low-level juvenile delinquency. And, more than any other borough of Toronto, Scarborough has produced more of what I call juvenile delinquent geniuses. This is not a contradiction in terms. I hung out with a bad group of kids in Scarborough, all of them juvies. But they were good at being juvies. My juvenile delinquent mentor was a kid we shall call Billy. Billy lived in one of those, quote-unquote, nice houses, and his mom was what I believe the kids now refer to as a MILF. A flight attendant for Air Canada, even though she was well past the best-before date, what my dad would call mutton dressed as lamb. Billy's dad was a successful businessman who lived in Jupiter, Florida, and was often described by Billy's mom as a powerful man. What his powers were exactly was left to the imagination. Billy's dad would visit once every 2 months. He would arrive with a hero gift, usually something like a mini bike. In the interim, each time I went over to Billy's house, his mom was entertaining a different man, all of whom wore the same shorty robe. Billy called these gentlemen Mommy's special sleepover friends. Billy took his delinquency to the level of performance art. One performance involves scamming the deposit on milk jugs. But first, let me take this moment to acknowledge that Canada has a complicated relationship when it comes to the packaging of milk. Milk is packaged in three ways in Canada. The first, the standard cardboard carton. The second is plastic bags. Milk is sold in plastic bags that are roughly the same size and shape as IV bags and require a specially made pitcher. One would assume that you would pour the milk into this pitcher, but no. One places the unopened milk bag inside the pitcher, good luck, and then cuts one corner of the milk bag to allow pouring. If you cut the corner too much, you get a milk tsunami. Too little, and it's a dribble. There are two words for this design: inexplicable and demented. Speaking of demented, let's get back to Billy. Billy's milk jug scam involved the third type of Canadian milk packaging, gallon jugs. At the local Dominion, you could return empty gallon jugs for a 10-cent deposit. The disinterested cashiers at Dominion never looked up when milk jugs were being returned to the bin in front of their cash register. When they heard the rattle of the jugs, without looking, they would robotically ask, "How many?" Here's where Billy's genius came into play. He would simply shake the deposit bin, offering no milk jugs. The unsuspecting cashier would ask, "How many?" Billy would coolly reply, 10. He used the ill-gotten dollar to pay for the candy that he was buying as a cover for the stolen candy stuffed in his bomber jacket. He would steal Hostess Hickory Sticks, Tahiti Treat Soda, Big Turk Chocolate Bars, Eat More's, Mr. Big, and Lick-A-Maid. One day, he shoplifted a turkey. Another day, shrimp salad. Unsatisfied with the plain shrimp, he went back in and shoplifted cocktail sauce. Then he went home and stole a bottle of cheap wine you could only get in Canada, depressingly named Lonesome Charlie. Lonesome Charlie's tagline was, "Lonesome Charlie's looking for a friend." Wow, morbid and bleak. The most surreal example of Billy's juvenile delinquent genius was what I call the manhole cover incident. We'd been throwing snowballs at cars, and we'd been bumper hitching. For those of you not familiar with bumper hitching, it was the insanely unsafe, and I hope illegal, practice of grabbing onto the bumper of a car driving on a snowy street. We called it Scarborough water skiing. Volkswagen Beetles were the best to bumper hitch because the tubing on the rear bumper formed unintended handles. The best results for bumper hitching were achieved by wearing hard shoes with no tread, like Peter Pan getaway boots. That day, Billy noticed that some workers from Bell Canada had gone to lunch and had left their gear by the side of the road. He picked up a manhole cover crowbar, opened up a manhole in the middle of the road, and wedged the crowbar so that it was sticking straight up. I watched in disbelieving silence. I didn't know where this was going. Then a car came along and smashed its front end into the crowbar. Billy started laughing uncontrollably. The driver came out pissed. Billy then started to shout towards the manhole cover, "Jim, run! He's coming down into the manhole to get you!" Billy lied that there was a kid in the sewer who was sticking the crowbar out of the manhole to damage passing cars. Of course, there was no Jim, and the driver removed the manhole cover and went down into the manhole chasing after, quote-unquote, Jim. As soon as the driver was at the bottom of the ladder, Billy calmly slid the manhole cover back into place, got into the driver's car, and rolled the car so that the front wheel was on top of the manhole cover, trapping the driver down inside the manhole. Then Billy shouted down at him, "You asshole!" as if it was the driver's fault. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that it was right, but it takes the mind of a genius to move juvenile delinquency to the next dimension, performance art. During the winter months, we would have endless table hockey tournaments. One day, mid-tournament, Billy turned to us and asked if we were hungry. We were too busy, so he excused himself, saying that he was going upstairs to make a meal. 20 minutes later, he came downstairs with a Chinette plate with what appeared to be sausages and some sort of vegetable. But as soon as he came down, there was a horrible stench. Of course, if you get 8 young boys together, someone will inevitably fart, but this was different, and Billy seemed oblivious. Unnoticed was the fact that Billy was now wearing nice clothes, had combed his hair with an old-timey middle part, had a napkin tucked into his shirt, mob style, and was incessantly fussing with his cutlery, never really digging into his sausage. Upon further examination of the sausage, it was clear that he had, in fact, taken a dump on the Chinette plate and garnished his turd sausages with parsley. I had to choose between laughing and throwing up in my mouth. I chose laughing. I don't know how he thought such a thing up, and while genius is usually reserved for accomplishments like string theory, part of me thinks that Billy might actually be juvenile delinquency's first